C&W Facility Services versus Secretary of Labor. Mr. Metzger?
Good morning. May it please the court. Tom Metzger on behalf of the petitioner, C&W Facility Services, Inc. Getting to the heart of the matter, this case involves respondents, or OSHA's, effort to enforce a performance standard under OSHA's rules as opposed to a specification standard. And OSHA is seeking to require, in this case, a specific form of personal protective equipment when there's been no finding of any industry custom or practice, and there's no precedent suggesting that this was required in the past. In this circuit, the primary threshold question on enforcement of a performance standard such as we have here in 1910.132a is whether there is some identified custom or practice in the employer's industry which would then give the employer some fair notice of a requirement for that particular personal protective equipment that OSHA is now saying was required to have been used.
So it could be that there would be a custom, but there's really no evidence of that here as I understand it. Then the question becomes, does the employer have actual knowledge, not only of the danger, but of the need for the protective equipment, right?
That's right, Your Honor. So first as to whether there was any evidence of industry custom in this case. Of course, it's been conceded by the respondent that there was not. In addition, the lead safety executive for the petitioner also testified that he was not aware of, and C&W Facility Services is not aware of, any industry or custom, any industry custom or practice.
I know that's why we're on actual knowledge, so I suggest you go to the sufficiency of the evidence of actual knowledge.
Yes.
Because that's what the case is going to turn on. And certainly the jury, the fact finder, it's not a jury here, it's a fact finder, I guess ALJ, can consider the fact that there's no rule, there's no requirement. That's one thing they can consider. The lack of custom and practice goes to lack of actual knowledge that it was needed.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. So that, yes.
But the ALJ set forth what the ALJ believed was sufficient evidence to find actual knowledge, not only of the hazard, but the need, danger, hazard, however you want to call it, but also the need for the particular protective equipment.
Correct, Your Honor. So in the analysis on actual knowledge, first, the administrative law decision incorrectly applied what that standard is, because where the administrative law judge stopped was at the first part of the analysis. There are two hurdles to that actual knowledge component. The first is whether there's a hazard, of course. Mm-hmm. And what the judge emphasized in the opinion was that there's a hazard of somebody working by water. That's essentially where the analysis stopped. There is no discussion of the next piece which this circuit has looked at, as to how does somebody know there's actual knowledge? How do we define that? In other words, what is there, what substantial evidence is there of actual knowledge? The
when you say actual knowledge, I want to drill down, actual knowledge of what?
Yes. So it is whether the employer had actual knowledge that a hazard requires the use of some other additional personal protective equipment.
So not just of the hazard, but of the requirement for use of personal equipment.
Precisely.
And we've got a trilogy of cases from the former Fifth Circuit that are binding precedent in our circuit that say it's not enough that you know that there's a workplace hazard. You have to know, too, of the actual requirement for that personal protective equipment. Here it's a life preserver, right?
That's correct.
One of the cases from the former Fifth Circuit was steel-toed shoes.
Correct.
Right? The gloves in handling fiberglass and Owens Corning, S&H riggers, the safety belts, all of those turned on. What you say your case turns on is a lack of proof that the employer had actual knowledge of the need for that personal protective equipment, right?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And as I understand it, here, there had never been an injury of this kind for lack of a life preserver. Is that right?
Yes. So on that point, and I'll come back to the substantial evidence.
Some employees had worn life preservers, voluntarily worn them.
There was evidence of two over the course of 4 years.
Right.
Who had voluntarily worn it on two separate occasions.
But of course, in the Cotter case, there were employees who voluntarily wore steel-toed shoes.
That's exactly right. So on the administrative law judge decision did not address that component either, because in this circumstance, there was an extremely rare, isolated set of two cases that were testified to in which somebody voluntarily decided to use a PFD. One of them was on a dock. The other person was not on the dock. Over the course of 4 years of this work being performed, week in and week out, no one else used a PFD. No one else had said they need a PFD.
So how would you show, how would the government show that the knowledge of this requirement existed? Obviously, you could show if there had been many horrible accidents where people had been injured or otherwise harmed from lack of this, then you could show it. But other than past incidents, is there a way to demonstrate sufficient knowledge of this requirement?
The primary method that the trilogy of cases that are relevant here address, the primary one is whether there are a significant number of injuries or not. So it's that component as addressed in Cotter & Co. and the related cases talking about whether there were a significant number of injuries or not. So going, for example, to the question of whether someone needed to require their employees to have steel-toed shoes. In that case, what they looked at was, yes, there were some injuries. Yes, some employees voluntarily wore it, but it did not rise to the level of a significant number of injuries given the amount of work they did. And
there was proof that one injury would not have occurred or would have been prevented or mitigated by steel-toed shoes, but the former Fifth Circuit said that one incident's not enough.
That's precisely right. There were a total of three injuries that OSHA
but in Owens Corning, the glass, the wearing the gloves for fiberglass to prevent fiberglass itch over a 30-year period, the employer knew that the only way that there was that was a common problem, the development of that fiberglass itch, and that the only equipment that prevented that injury was wearing gloves, right?
Right. The Owens Corning case is significant from that standpoint of showing that type of evidence, in that Owens Corning emphasized there were 30 years, for 30 years, the employer was aware of this particular injury occurring. The employees at Owens Corning had persistently requested the use of gloves, and there was a high percentage of employees who had demanded that particular personal protective equipment. And the injury was occurring all the time. That is just the opposite of what we have here. We have 4 years of activity that was being performed on that dock.
I want to make sure I understand your argument. I'm looking at page 73 of the fact finder's opinion, and he's saying, first, the secretary must show clear actual knowledge that personal protective equipment was necessary under the circumstances. So he's acknowledging the standard there, correct?
He does cite to the case that we cited to in our post.
No, he does more than that. He says must show clear actual knowledge that personal protective equipment was necessary under the circumstances.
That's a correct statement of the requirement of proof, isn't it?
It's a correct statement of it. Yes.
Okay, all right. And then later on page, that same page, I'm just trying to make sure I understand what I think is the sole issue here. The facts, he then makes a fact finding. The facts demonstrate that respondent had, quote, clear actual knowledge that PPA was necessary under the circumstances, end quote. So really what we're talking about is the sufficiency of the evidence to support that fact finding. Isn't that what we're down to here, whether there was enough evidence here?
I think it's twofold, Your Honor. When we look at the actual decision, under no circumstance does, in his analysis, after he cites the case, under no circumstance does he then go through the analysis and say that it's something other than recognition of the hazard. Even his conclusion in that section of the
So you're
opinion,
saying he stated the rule correctly, but there's nothing in the decision that shows he actually applied it. The only actual application is to the first part of the test, that is the knowledge of the hazard itself.
That is precisely right.
All right.
And on
I'll give you an example where I think he goes somewhat further. I don't know whether he should have done more or not, but he says the facts demonstrate he had clear actual knowledge, and he says he certainly looks at the open and obvious part. He also looks at no lattice, and he said, and he uses this, he says, the supervisor even asked Mr. Norton if he could swim. So that he uses that, and he said that shows they knew there was a hazard if you couldn't swim. Okay, so that's part of his analysis of they were aware of the hazard because they were asking everybody that worked there on this dock to make sure they could swim.
First, Mr. Norton had said he could swim. That's the evidence. In addition, they
did
not ask.
That's why I'm going to the sufficiency. We'll get to the sufficiency. I'm trying to get you to see why there's any other issue other than sufficiency, because you say, oh, he doesn't apply it, he doesn't do this. Your brief is a lot about he uses the wrong standard. Okay, and we're not looking for perfection here. We're trying to see if he states the standard. He says, I'm now apply the standard. I find facts. And so what seems like all we've got to do here, I agree there's some conflicting language in other places, but we've got to decide whether there's enough evidence to say to support that one fact finding.
Sure. And on the open and obvious question, S&H Riggers has rejected that argument. It's from the circuit, saying that you can't then do an end run around the requirement of finding a specific requirement by then OSHA later after the fact saying, well, it was obvious to us that there was a requirement because it's never been defined by industry or by any precedent prior. In addition, he never addresses the key component that all of our cases address in this circuit, which is, were there any prior injuries or incidents? There was no fall, there was no trip, there was no injury whatsoever.
I'm not sure you have to show a prior injury. I've had a case where somebody was on a construction site. The site's being built. There can't be prior injuries. The site's just being built right then and there. And somebody's on a wall and falls, and it's an OSHA violation, and we've affirmed it.
You shouldn't have
somebody way up there without some buckle around them.
That is the distinction, because there are specification standards for that. There's a certain height at which OSHA says you cannot work above without fall protection. 4 feet in the general industry, 6 feet in construction industry. If the individual is working above that level, they fall, they did not have fall protection, there's no argument that the employer was not on notice.
Okay, Mr. Metzger, you've gone over, but you were answering our questions, so You've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Why don't we hear from Ms. Shriver?
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Leanne Shriver, and I represent the U.S. Department of Labor in this matter. Johnny Norton worked at the Tampa Convention Center, where he was on the payroll for OnClean, which was a subcontractor for C&W Facility Services. While he was pressure washing the dock, he unfortunately fell into the water, and because he was not wearing a personal flotation device, he drowned.
I'll tell you where I am. I think there's, you know, I think the employee argument is meritless. I think there's plenty of evidence of actual knowledge of a hazard. The question is whether there's enough here, there's sufficient evidence to support a finding that the employer had actual knowledge of the need for a life preserver. And it looks to me like the ALJ conflated actual knowledge of the hazard with actual knowledge of the need for the personal protective equipment. And it looks to me like circuit precedent from our predecessor circuit says that that's wrong. What am I missing?
Your Honor, I believe the ALJ cites a number of facts that it uses to support its determination that there was in fact actual knowledge that this form of PPE was required. Specifically, there was evidence that other workers had worn the personal flotation device.
Two other workers in 4 years, right?
Two workers out of eight workers who had conducted
that work.
How was
that any different from the Cotter case where some employees used steel-toed shoes?
I think it's a piece of the evidence here. I think in combination with the other evidence that the ALJ relied on, it is sufficient.
Okay, what other evidence?
Specifically that Mr. Norton's supervisor, Mr. Sheehan, asked him whether or not he could swim when assigning the task, and stated to the OSHA compliance officer that he asked this question because a prior worker had worn a personal flotation device because of concerns about working near the water. That means that Mr. Sheehan, whose knowledge can be imputed to C&W, had both actual knowledge of the hazard and that PPE would have mitigated the hazard here.
Well, what he had actual knowledge of, it seems to me from that fact, is that an ability to swim would be what he needed to avoid injury. He didn't ask a question about a life preserver, did he?
He did not ask the question about whether or not Mr. Norton wanted a life jacket. However, the commission has held in at least one instance that in a case where workers were asked to volunteer to swim across a gravel pit in order to get a line across, and a worker drowned halfway across, that it was still necessary to provide that worker with a personal flotation device, indicating that the commission does not believe that the ability to swim is sufficient.
Of course, here we had never had an injury, right, for lack of a life preserver, right?
I agree, Your Honor. However, I believe that the OSH Act is designed to prevent the first injury, and so it can't be that the only way to show actual knowledge is that other people have already died. And so there are other forms of evidence.
Going back to the Cotter case, where there actually was a previous injury that would have been mitigated or prevented by the use of steel-toed shoes, our predecessor circuit said that wasn't enough. Even where there was an incident.
You're referring to Cotter, Your Honor?
Yes.
So in that case, I believe we are fully factually distinguishable from that, because there were three prior injuries. Two of them could not have been prevented by the PPE in question.
But one of them could have been.
One of them could have been, but the employer had put an alternative mitigation device in place to deal with that hazard. The workers directly violated a policy that employer had put in place, which was about tossing cartons back and forth.
What about the alternative mitigation of making sure that everyone can swim?
C&W didn't do that.
Well, they did it with this individual.
Only with this individual. And in fact, the secretary does not believe that swimming is sufficient mitigation, because there are many circumstances in which someone can wind up in the water, right? In the job hazard analysis for this job, For pressure washing, there was awareness of the risk of slips, trips, and falls. And if Mr. Norton had slipped, hit his head, and gone into the water, he would have been unconscious, and his ability to swim wouldn't matter.
It strikes me that if I were pressure washing docks all day in the hot sun, I would be really annoyed if I had to wear a life jacket. It seemed that that would get in the way, make me hotter. I think that goes to whether it's something that's obviously needed. If I can very easily imagine that employees would find it not only not necessarily but frustrating, that seems different from the type of open and obvious danger where if you're working in a radiation facility, obviously everyone needs to wear radiation protective equipment even if there's no regulation for it. But in something like this where I can easily imagine that employees would find it frustrating rather than helpful, why don't you need to look for some obvious dangers rather than just a supposition that in some rare circumstances someone could hit their head and get hurt?
Your Honor, I believe that whether a personal protective equipment would be annoying to a worker is not particularly relevant. I do agree that if the PPE in question posed some additional form of hazard, if there was an alternative hazard it created, that would be a different matter. But no one here has argued that the personal flotation device would have made the job more hazardous. If it's just annoying for employees to wear, we still have to protect those employees.
So I want to go back to where Mr. Metzger had started in a sense, and that is that one way to hold the employer liable is to prove that there is an industry custom of using this personal protective equipment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're talking about, we don't have that here, right? We don't have that evidence or an argument that that was satisfied here. And so what we're dealing here is with an alternative to that proof, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it sounds like it sounds to me like it's a particularly tough standard for the agency because it's really an alternative to that industry custom norm. And that because that's what it's really a substitute for, it's not enough for the agency to prove that there was actual knowledge of a danger, a hazard. Maybe even actual knowledge that personal protective equipment could mitigate the damage, but that the actual knowledge has to be that that the personal protective equipment is necessary for the employee. So you have situations where if you can satisfy that high standard, it doesn't matter that there's not an industry custom, which is the norm. That's the baseline. That's what you would ordinarily have to prove. And it seems to me that the problem here is that the ALJ has really conflated the known danger with a proof that there's actual knowledge for the need of personal protective equipment, which these earlier circuit precedents say that's not enough. What am I missing?
I think specifically the earlier cases from the Fifth Circuit all deal with different forms of proving actual knowledge. Prior injuries can show actual knowledge. Voluntary provision of protective equipment cannot show knowledge. But here we have an unusual circumstance, because usually with actual knowledge you have to impute it from surrounding circumstances. But here we have a supervisor statement. We have a supervisor statement clearly indicating that he knew there was a hazard. He knew that a personal flotation device was necessary, could mitigate it. And
well, but it was necessary?
I think by virtue of him asking the question, it shows that he thought this was a reasonably likely to
occur. But the question he asked was about an ability to swim.
I agree. But I still think that just by virtue of asking the question, it still shows all of the elements that this court could interpret from the prior Fifth Circuit, which is that the PPE, that there was a hazard, that it was a reasonably likely hazard. So you know that, right, the purpose of the OSHA standard is that employers are to look at their work sites and look for dangers. And once they see those dangers, evaluate how likely they are and if they can prevent them. And in this case, C&W had all that information and still didn't provide him with the personal flotation device that would have saved his life.
You just said they have to consider how likely they are, which I think it's fair to say this doesn't seem especially likely, given that there hadn't been any incidents before. And it seems like ensuring that people could swim is a way to greatly mitigate the hazards of nearby water.
If that had been CNW's policy to generally make sure that other people could swim, I think it might be possibly an argument. I still would argue that the ability to swim is not sufficient to mitigate this hazard because there are so many ways that you could wind up in the water. Even the fact that Mr. Norton was wearing heavy boots that would have made it extremely difficult for him to swim in. There are a lot of other circumstances in which someone winds up in the water and their ability to swim does not mitigate that hazard. And I don't think that this court should view the personal abilities of workers.
So it really comes down, though, in your argument is that the evidence that that supervisor asked, can you swim, proves, that's the evidence that proves that the employer had actual knowledge of the need for a life preserver. Is that right?
That and the fact that he acknowledged that he knew that a prior worker had worn a personal flotation device because he was concerned about the water and that he asked this question because of that knowledge. Right? Ultimately,
What had he asked the prior worker, Mr. Sheehan? He had talked to the worker that wore the device. What did Mr. Sheehan say his conversation was with the prior worker?
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record about that.
Okay.
I believe that he just had the knowledge that that worker was concerned about the water.
Okay, so there's no direct testimony about that. So all that we have is that he asked Mr. Norton if he could swim. That's one thing. And before that, he noticed another employee wore it because he was concerned about the danger.
So I believe it's one step further than that, Your Honor, which is that he told the compliance officer in this case that he asked Mr. Norton that question because he had seen that other worker wear the personal flotation device. And I think that is an extra layer here.
Doesn't that suggest that he thought a personal flotation device would be necessary if you didn't know how to swim?
I think all we know is that the prior worker was concerned about falling in the water. I think that it is not appropriate to conclude that if he knew that there was a hazard and that it was entirely possible that Mr. Norton would face that hazard and that PPE was able to mitigate it, I think that whether or not Mr. Norton could swim is not the relevant consideration, especially with the other factors surrounding.
It's hard for me to see how that could be if you're placing so much emphasis on the fact that he asked the worker if he could swim. Why would we draw that connection in one place but not draw it in the other?
I think because it is unlikely that Mr. Sheehan would have concluded that swimming was sufficient to mitigate the hazard here.
Then why would he ask if he didn't think it made a difference?
Your Honor, I do not know why this man would ask if Mr. Norton could swim because he knew that a personal flotation device would mitigate the hazard and did not provide that personal flotation device. I think that was an error in judgment, and he knew that he should have, and that knowledge can be imputed to C&W.
This just seems to me like the conversion of basically a negligence standard into something where the law requires a lot more.
I don't think it's a negligence standard because we have such strong proof of actual knowledge here. I think the fact that
knowledge of the danger. This is the very point that our predecessor circuit's precedents turn on, what is the faulty premise that the presence of an obvious hazard by itself gives notice of the need to provide safety belts or other protective equipment. That's S&H Riggers. It's the same problem that existed in Cotter. I'm having a hard time distinguishing those cases here.
I think because those cases have not laid out a bright line test for what you need in addition to actual knowledge of the hazard, it's hard for this court to say, yes, this meets every single element. But because this is factually distinguishable from all of the other reasons that those courts found that knowledge of the hazard alone was insufficient, I think that it would still be appropriate to affirm this as the ALJ having sufficient evidence to support that determination.
Is it any evidence standard, substantial evidence? What is the evidentiary requirement?
It's a substantial evidence standard.
Substantial evidence.
I see that my time is up, and so the Secretary asks that this court affirm the ALJ's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Betzker, you've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
The requirement is for the Secretary to demonstrate clear actual knowledge of a requirement by substantial evidence. And in this case, we have significant components from prior precedent that is absolutely missing. As discussed, there is no customer practice they could identify. As discussed, there's no prior injury they could point to, not even an incident of someone falling in the water and them recognizing the conditions on the dock present some unique hazard. This was a wide dock.
Well, you got a death now. Now you got a prior incident.
And the case is you're
from
on a point
high dock where somebody fell in that couldn't swim. I wondered why he died so fast, but I think I now know the answer. Because he just went down. It's those heavy boots, apparently. I mean, he didn't make it 30 seconds or something.
And
is that right?
He did go down quickly, Your Honor, yes. And looking at that case and this court's prior precedent, looking back and then deciding that there was some requirement known to the employer, that there was actual knowledge of a requirement based upon a single, essentially freak accident on this dock. Because after all, Your Honor, this is a public dock where other companies were working on it. The compliance
with all due respect, I don't think falling off at dock is a freak accident when you got equipment and out there in heavy boots. I think that's really not fair. But in any event, why should we not remand to the ALJ since most of your brief is how they didn't apply the right standard and tell him very specifically and tell the agency, here is the standard, go back and apply more clearly, more precisely. Here's the standard. Everybody put in what other evidence they want to do. Why should we not do that in light of the very confusing nature of the ALJ order in this case?
For several reasons, Your Honor. First, the respondent was fully aware of the precedent from this circuit regarding not only industry custom and practice, but also then the requirement in the absence of industry custom or practice to prove by substantial evidence that in fact there was actual knowledge, none of which we have here under the facts of this case, and those facts aren't going to change, given that what this circuit has emphasized time and again is...
I understand it, though. That is what we would do. We would vacate the decision and remand it for further proceedings. And you could have, could you not, further evidence provided and new fact-finding.
Your Honor, the citation should be vacated and dismissed because there is no finding of actual knowledge of a requirement and there's no evidence of that, despite the fact that was the standard going into this case. And when we apply the precedent and look at these prior cases in which this court vacated the citation, we're asking that the same thing happen just as it did in the earlier case.
It seems like if we decided that the court had stated the right standard but didn't have sufficient evidence, then we would vacate and dismiss. Whereas if we decided that the court used and applied the wrong standard, it would be more appropriate to vacate and remand.
Well, essentially, Your Honor, the judge or the ALJ decision is flawed in both respects in that there was the incorrect standard applied, but then even looking at actual knowledge, there is not substantial evidence of actual knowledge, and therefore, on this record, it should be vacated and dismissed.
Okay, I think we understand your case. We're going to take a 10-minute break. We'll be in recess.
Thank you.